Coast to coast and worldwide on the internet. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Tonight our guest is Dr. Helen Morrison, and we're going to continue with our special report on serial killers. Her research, her book, My Life Among the Serial Killers, she's looked into the minds of more than 80 serial killers over the course of 25 years. Born May 21st, 1960, Jeffrey Dahmer was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. When he was young, he impaled the heads of animals he killed on stakes in his yard. As an adolescent, he had fantasies of killing and mutilating men. His first murder was in Bath Township in Ohio in 1978. I want you to hear this.
One of the main reasons for my continuing to do the things I did for so long was because I felt that I didn't have to be accountable to anybody. From about 15 years on up, a great deal of my thoughts were basically unshareable with anyone. I had this reoccurring fantasy of meeting a hitchhiker on the road and of taking him hostage and doing what I wanted with him. And I never in my wildest nightmares thought that it would become a reality. I wish I just kept on going, but I didn't. Turned around, picked him up, and that's when the nightmare became a reality. There was a big element of wanting complete control over someone, total control, not having to consider their wishes, being able to keep them there as long as I wanted, and That was a big part of it.
Arrested in 1991. That was in February also of 92. Dahmer was then sentenced to 15 life consecutive terms. In the following May, a 16th consecutive life sentence was added for murder. Dahmer admitted to his crimes and declined to shift blame. He was murdered by another inmate, November 28, 1994, in Portage, Wisconsin prison. In a moment, our guest, Dr. Helen Morrison, as we dive into the minds of serial killers. Dr. Helen Morrison is certified by the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology for General Psychiatry, as well as Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. She is also a certified forensic psychiatrist. Dr. Morrison is the editor, co-author of 4 academic books and the author, co-author of more than 125 published articles in her professional field. Having worked with both in the United States and international law enforcement, she has made presentations in more than 15 countries, over 200 presentations right here in the United States alone. Over the course of 25 years, Dr. Morrison has profiled more than 80 serial killers worldwide, and what she has learned will shatter every assumption that you have ever heard. In her role as consultant to a variety of law enforcement agencies, she has interviewed and studied such notables as John Wayne Gacy, Ed Gein, Wayne Williams, along with many, many others. Tonight on Coast to Coast, our special guest, Dr. Helen Morrison. Hello, Doctor. How are you?
Hello. I'm fine. And you?
Good to have you with us.
Well, it's so nice to be with you. Thanks for the opportunity.
You know, we have for about a year now, we've been looking for several experts who have truly devoted their careers into investigating the minds of serial killers. And I've got to tell you, you have come so highly recommended. I'm just I'm thrilled that we've got this opportunity to talk
with you. Well, thank
you. You know, a lot of people, Helen, don't really understand that living next door to them could very well be someone who fits these profiles.
So often, one of the biggest things that we hear is the neighbors saying, but he couldn't have done that. I mean, I saw him every day, and I never suspected. He was a nice guy. He was helpful. He never caused any trouble. There wasn't anything going on that we knew of. And people are generally very shocked. And absolutely, they come across as Mr. Milquetoast, and very frequently they're kind and helpful, and they're also murderers.
If you were living next to them, even with all your background, your training, would you be able to see some quirks in them, or would they be able to get through and not even you would believe that they had this potential?
I would say that they would get by me.
The
thing that's so fascinating and the reason that this work is so interesting is that each one of them, subsequently that you see them, are cookie cutters of one another, but you don't ever see anything externally. I think that's one of the myths, that a serial murderer is someone who has to be disheveled and wild-eyed, running down the street, you know, muttering in obscenities. But they are just completely like everyone else externally.
Explain the difference, because I'm sure there are many, between a serial killer and a mass murderer.
One of the things that we discovered in the early parts of our work 25, 30 years ago was that people thought murderers were murderers. And subsequently, as we began to look at the serial killers, we also began to become interested in these mass murderers. I'm talking about the McDonald who shoots up the playground, or the postal worker who goes in and blows everyone away. What we've discovered is that the mass murderer has a definite motive for murder. Generally, it's revenge, because they've felt slighted or left out, mm-hmm. or they haven't gotten their promotion, and they blow. Completely. And yet, when they do commit the homicides, they're very well planned. They've had a long-term grudge that they've held, and they generally kill themselves afterwards. It's not unusual. The serial murderer, on the other hand, really has absolutely no motive to kill. He does it. It's something he does. It's akin to going to get the car fixed or going grocery shopping. It has no emotional meaning for them.
And the serial killer doesn't know his victims, does he?
No. And that's one of the other myths that people said, is that the serial killer is always killing people that he knows or he has in his family. But the serial killer never, ever commits violence within his family structure.
In this most recent case, Dr. Morrison, where Dennis Rader out of Wichita, Kansas,
yes.
is now a suspect in at least 10 murders.
Yes.
He's been charged with 10. His family lived with him for years,
yes.
and never suspected anything. Now, you know, I'm not going to implicate the man. He's got to go to trial. That's our system of justice. However, one could assume that, you know, the cops may have their man. Now, in this particular case, my God, Ellen, what does the wife do? I mean, she's got to be in shock right now.
Well, you know, and that's one of the most interesting things, is the partners or the wives, and so many of them are married, so many of them have children, have absolutely no clue that the man that they are intimate with has been involved in these homicides. One of the most interesting and fascinating interviews I ever did was with the wife of John Gacy. Now, he had buried 33 bodies in the crawl space under his house, the floorboards. And that was obviously not a solid type of experience. And when he had these bodies there, obviously, if you've ever smelled a dead body, you can't miss it. Well, when I finally had the opportunity to speak with her and talk about how in the world she didn't notice a smell.
Right.
And she said, well, she did.
Oh, my.
But she asked her husband, John Gacy, about it, and he told her it was only mice. And she went along and never, ever thought about the possibility that there could be bodies there. There was a recent serial murderer in Louisiana whose significant other was told by him to just don't go near the computer. He would leave the house about 11 o'clock at night, come back about 3 o'clock in the morning, and the police were going to arrest her. They felt that she had to be knowledgeable about what was going on. She had to be an accessory.
Right.
Well, when they asked her about this, you know, what did you think? I mean, this man is telling you not to go near the computer. He's telling you not to pay attention. He goes out and he comes back. What did you think? And her response was, well, I thought all men did that.
Well, I've got to tell you, I mean, if even though, and we're going to get into this later, why we don't have a lot of women serial killers, I mean, it does happen, but, you know, if someone were to say to me that you know, your wife is a serial killer and you don't see these signs, I mean, I would be one of the staunchest people to defend her, you know.
And that happens all the time, where the partners or the relatives say it couldn't be him. When I talk to the brothers and sisters of the serial murderers, and they are astounded and continue to assert the innocence of their brother, and they still carry a tremendous amount of denial. They have to have the wrong man. It couldn't possibly be him. They've gotten him confused with someone else. That is so constant. But you can, I mean, you're absolutely right. The devastation of knowing that this thing that you were living with is that much of a monster and you didn't know.
Does the reality ever sink in with these people? Do they say to themselves, oh, now, wait a minute, I do remember the day he did this to our pet, or I remember this strange look he had on his face when he saw something on television. Do they start to reflect like that?
No, never,
they
because
don't.
These people don't show anything like that. They don't have strange looks. They don't hurt their pets. They just go along. They live their lives, and that's why the shock of discovery is even more difficult for them to handle.
Now, I just read a little bit about Jeffrey Dahmer.
Yes.
Before you came on. And one of the things apparently he did when he was a kid, though, is he tortured animals. Is that a myth, or does that happen with some of these serial killers?
On occasion, it happens. You know, in the early days of looking at people who murdered individuals, there was this kind of idea that you could predict who a murderer was going to be by the fact that they would torture animals, set fires, and wet their beds, that famous triad.
Mm-hmm.
But of the many that we've studied, and we have over 80 now, that is such a rare occurrence. What they generally do is they treat their human victims as if they were animals, with no feelings, with no thoughts, and with nothing other than observable pain.
How many serial killers do you think, Dr. Morrison, might be roaming around this country right now?
I would say probably 60 or so. The FBI has given statistics in the past that, you know, for everyone that's caught, there are 7 out there. I would find that difficult because our techniques have gotten very good about connecting victims now. So we can generally say, okay, these crimes are all DNA connected, therefore we have one serial murderer. But I would find it very difficult to say that there are 560 out there.
So if there are 60,
yes,
how many potential deaths per serial killer are we talking about? At least 10.
You know, the thing is even with the gentleman in Kansas City who's been accused of these crimes, mm-hmm, and alleged to have committed these 10 crimes, if you look back at his history, he would have started when he was 38. That's very old for a serial killer. Serial killers begin to kill in adolescence, age 14 or 15. they do their first crime, and then they take a break. And then gradually, as they start to take more victims and kill more victims, they increase the amount of people that they kill, and the time between the killings becomes more and more short. So we're saying that, you know, 10 is a very conservative number. We never know exactly how many victims a serial murderer kills because he doesn't remember them all.
And even though we may have some convicted serial killers or those who may be dead, and we may say this person is the record setter as a serial killer, right, there could be people out there right now who have killed hundreds.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when people were going around saying that John Gacy had killed 37, well, he killed more than that, but the Russian Chikatilo killed over 100, and the Peruvian serial killer killed over 100.
What was the name of the person who killed the migrant farmers years ago?
Oh,
do you remember that one?
I do. And I blank on his name because he was such a braggart. He never could have killed the number of people he said he killed. He never would have slept. And
we'll get his name in a second.
Yeah.
Someone will send it to us both.
It'll come to both of us. But he also went ahead after he had confessed to several. And then after a period of time, he started saying 100, 200. And the interesting thing was that everybody took him terribly seriously.
Juan Corona.
Juan Corona, right.
J-U-A-N, yep.
Yes, J-U-A-N, Juan Corona. And eventually the investigators decided that he was just bragging.
What's wrong with these people? I mean, obviously, people who murder, I think there's something wrong with them in the first place. I mean, there's a disregard for human life. But in a serial killer's case, in one respect, because of their methodology, they're brilliant in one respect because they know these things, they have clues, they've worked things out. On another respect, obviously, they're sick individuals. So what triggers this?
Wow, that's a big question. We know from all the studies we've done that nothing triggers them. After they've committed their first homicide as an adolescent, they take this sort of break. And what we've been able to connect is that it's very similar to a drug addict. They have a drug of choice, the victim that they choose.
Mm-hmm.
They take that drug. They have no reaction to it. But they need more of the drug, and they need to do it more frequently. But unlike the addict, they have absolutely no gratification from the murders themselves. It becomes an act, solely an act.
Do you think they have any remorse after it?
Oh, no. No.
No.
Okay. No. In fact, they never quite understand why people are so upset with them. When they go to trial, if they do anymore, most of them are smart enough now to just plead guilty. They don't even try an insanity defense anymore. They just do it. It's almost, again, to them, like signing off on a list and saying, okay, that's it, we're done, let's go on to the next thing.
Why hasn't the serial killer attempted to kill the person he might be living with or his friends? You know, again,
right,
these are people who live with him every day. They have no idea that he is what he is.
Right.
Why does he go after a targeted group or specific types of people and not his own friends?
Well, again, one of the things about being in a family situation or in a friend situation is they provide an external structure within which the serial murderer can function.
And he needs that.
Role.
He needs that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the most striking things that we know about serial killers is when they get to prison, these monsters, so to speak, become trustees. They start to run things. They are trusted. They are given access to knives in kitchens. They're allowed free rein within wherever they happen to be and whatever range they
mm-hmm.
happen to be. And people forget what they've done because they are so easy to get along with. And within the structure of the prison, they can manage very well.
Other than their killing habits, they appear to be normal.
Oh, absolutely normal. And again, we all have this expectation that they're all going to look like Hannibal Lecter you know, with this crazy glint in their eye. But absolutely not. That's a typical Hollywood manufactured myth.
That's scary because they could be right next to us.
Oh, absolutely.
Helen, when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about whether you believe it could be genetic or not and some other issues. Later on tonight, we're going to open up the phone lines again. Our guest is Dr. Helen Morrison. Her book, My Life Among the Serial Killers. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
Subscribe to After Dark. Call toll-free 1-888-727-5505. From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Hey, if you get a moment, get up to the enterprisemission.com website. Richard C. Hoagland sent me a little note. He's got part four of his investigation of the Saturn moon Iapetus. Take a look at that. He's working on part five now, but he's got number four up and ready to go. Not too distant future, we'll get Richard back to talk a little bit about parts four and five. After Dark newsletter, it's always available to you. You get 14 issues for the price of 12. A couple ways you can order it. As a matter of fact, they're working now on the April issue, and I'm working on my editorial. I think you'll like it. It's going to be about flu vaccines. 1-888-727-5505. That's the toll-free number. There are operators there 24 hours a day. We even keep one there, you know, around the clock. Even if the others go home, we keep that one there. 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our special guest tonight, Dr. Helen Morrison. Helen, with the mind of a serial killer, yes, do they kill for a specific period of time, stop and resume again, or in some cases, like possibly what we're seeing in Wichita, Kansas, the individual just stops and doesn't go back to killing? What causes this time lapse?
We don't know what the time lapse is about. We do know that very similar to people who go off their drugs for a while, that they eventually do go back, that something makes them go back. But we've not been able to clarify why they do stop for periods of time, but it's not unusual. A lot of people say that they stop because they've been imprisoned or because they're in some type of trouble.
Or they died.
Or they died. That was the speculation about the Green River Killer, that he must have died because there hadn't been killings for a long period of time. But when you start looking at the patterns of how he killed, it's not unusual for these guys to travel to a completely different part of the country, kill there, come back to where they were, and nothing seems to happen in their neighborhood, so to speak. But there are these bodies scattered all over the country.
Well, that's so true. Now, do we know if they stop and just end it entirely, or do they always resume?
They always resume.
They do.
All yes, right. Absolutely. I mean, I am most fascinated by this individual in Kansas City because, as I said, 38 is usually the time when these people are caught.
Right.
Not when they start.
Right, when they start.
I want to know what happened in the 23 years prior to the time that he's identified his first homicide.
Something traumatic happened, no doubt.
No.
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 That's the other part of it. People have always said that serial murderers, they lost their parent or they lost their job or the reason they started all this was because their mother was seductive or crazy.
Right, or their father did something
to
them.
He was brutal or he was an alcoholic and so forth and so on. And without a doubt, that is not at all the case. There is nothing that sets them off except what we think and are speculating that there's something as puberty comes along when somebody goes into early adolescence, that the changes in brain chemistry trigger something inside that person's genetic makeup.
Around that period of time.
Yes, absolutely. Hmm. And we never expected that. I mean, when you start a project, you have no idea what you're doing. You collect data, and then you start comparing this data. And when we found out that the homicides began at that period of time, this was not passed down in families. None of the brothers, sisters, fathers, mothers had any violence in their background. Then we really had to start looking at, all right, is there something in the genetic makeup? Is there a little crinkle in a gene that occurs
mm-hmm.
prenatally? And then it's triggered by the brain chemistry and the hormonal changes.
And no one really sees this change.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. The only thing that happens generally as an adolescent is that they may get a little squirrely in school. They don't do their homework as much. They may not go so frequently. But there's no acting out. There's no robbery. There are no rapes. There are no...
And that's why they're so hard to find.
Oh, absolutely. They don't ever leave a clue.
Well, Helen, do they ever go home after one of these heinous murders and cry and go, oh my God, why did I do this, and try to stop, or do they just keep going?
They keep going. They don't have the capacity to maintain the memory of what they have done until something else reminds them of that. They don't go home and they don't think about it at all. It's very similar to when John Gacy killed Rob Peace, the last boy that he picked up.
Tell us this episode.
Well, John Gacy was a contractor. He would renovate drugstores, and he would be involved in, you know, various contracting things, concrete and so forth. And he would hire young men to come and help him. Well, he was at one of the drugstores giving an estimate, and he saw this young man. And the pharmacist said to the young man, oh, you know, that guy might be looking for help. He's a contractor, and he does hire people. Unbeknownst to John Gacy, the mother of the boy was sitting in her car in the parking lot. Rob went over to John Gacy mm-hmm. and said, I'm looking for a job. I hear you're hiring people.
And how old was the kid?
He was 16.
16, all right.
And he got in the truck, and that was the end of Rob Peast.
Now, what did Mom do during that point of time?
Well, he told his mother he was going to go with this guy because he was possibly going to get a job. And, of course, everyone was totally frantic, and they knew who he was. The police knew where he lived. The police went over there, and he said, well, I don't know anything about this. You know, I dropped him off at such and so. And the police obviously believed him. And this was when Pieced was bound and gagged in the room before he killed him.
Oh, he was there.
He was there.
They didn't even go check?
No, they did. I mean, you know, this guy didn't look like a madman. You know, he was just a...
Well, see, that's what police officers need to understand, that with a serial killer, they don't look crazy.
No, not at all. And they don't look suspicious, and they don't act suspicious. And, you know, most of us, if we killed someone, we would be a nervous wreck. Most. I'm not saying all. But these people show absolutely no emotion whatsoever, so there's nothing that triggers any suspicion.
I was reading a case on Jeffrey Dahmer that he had someone, had an Asian boy who he had drugged, and he left. Jeffrey left the house.
Right.
The boy revived, ran outside naked. Coupled girls called the police. They showed up. Jeffrey came back. They believed Jeffrey's story when he said, he's my lover, I'm sorry, he's drunk.
Yes.
They let him take him back in the house where he killed the kid.
He killed him.
Oh, my God.
The police never, ever suspected that Jeffrey Dahmer was the serial killer whose incidents had been posted all over every gay bar from Chicago to Milwaukee and back.
You have, by the way, talking about John Wayne Gacy, you have a piece of his brain, don't you?
I have his entire brain.
The whole thing.
Yes,
Is it look abnormal?
Oh, there's nothing. We've never found anything in his brain. We've done all of the techniques up to the most recent that we've been able to do on a dead brain, obviously. And there's nothing abnormal. There are no tumors. There are no holes. There are no extra wrinkles. There's nothing in that dead brain. But
normal
again,
size?
Oh, right? Normal size. It's as if I were looking at any other brain that I might take apart in the course of studying someone. And that's why we've so frequently said, please, let us do some work on the living brain. Let us do not experiments, but what we do on our regular patients, our seizure patients, where we will implant some electrodes, we'll do electrical recordings, see if there's anything abnormal, see if we can begin to identify a demonstrative pattern, and of course we're not allowed. We're going to, as they say, violate the rights of those individuals.
Well, let me ask you this then. What are the possibilities of this individual somehow getting, I don't know, attacked, possessed, pure evil, whatever it might be, has taken over his body, his soul, somehow?
That concept of evil is something that my profession is just beginning to even admit exists. The study of evil is something that's beginning to be looked at. When you're in the presence of these individuals, you don't really feel anything, because when you're with someone, you generally have a reaction to them. You like them, you don't like them, you have a snap judgment about
them.
But with a serial murderer, there is absolutely no emotion at all. They have no relatedness to human beings. But when you leave them, you're left with a sense of overwhelming fear, overwhelming, and it's very hard to describe. It's as if something has just come and taken every bit of life out of you. And it is, in the sense, if you're anybody who believes that good exists in the world, you have to say that the opposite exists, that evil exists in the world. And they're the closest personification that I can describe.
I'm just beginning to wonder, because of the lack of anyone being able to notice these people in the real world, that there must be something else involved in addition to some of these things you're all investigating now.
Well, we know that these people have absolutely none of the characteristics of a human being.
Now, explain that.
Well, you know, if you've ever been around a little baby, you know, somebody that's like 6 to 8 months old, There's a point in time where you can take that child and pass them around to the neighborhood or in the supermarket, and the child doesn't react at all. They treat everyone equally.
Yeah.
And there's a point in that first year of life where you try to do that with the very same child, and the child begins to show some distress. They might crinkle up their eyes.
Or
they
cry
might
for mommy.
Whimper,
or, yeah.
Or they'll reach for what their primary caretaker person is. And what we as child and adolescent psychiatrists look at is the developmental stage of becoming a person. We don't, obviously, we can't ask a baby if they're a person, but we can observe the fact that does this mean that this baby finally recognizes on their level that they are not the only thing in the world,
mm-hmm.
that they depend on the world for existence? And is that where that fear comes from, or that recognition on some level that they are dependent on the world? The serial murderer never reaches that stage of development.
And this, you could say, would be the case with all of them.
They are cookie cutters of one another. When we have a new one in Brazil right now, the ones that we've studied around the world, it's almost as if I took a cookie cutter and just cut them out and put them in different environments, but they are exactly alike.
There are serial killers all around this planet. Do we have more in the United States than other countries?
No, I don't believe that we have more here. I think our media is much more advanced here. When we started the work in Brazil, there was one, the first one was just a gigantic surprise to everyone. But it's a little bit like the issues of child abuse and battered partners, that once people are aware that it can happen, then they're able to connect things much better. And they say that, oh, there's such an increase in this. And no, it's an increase in recognition that this has happened.
I wonder what would happen, Helen, if you took all the current serial killers who are alive,
yes,
and just tossed them into a room. I wonder what they would say amongst each other.
Oh, generally when they're in contact with one another, they brotherhood. Oh, they do. They have a brotherhood, so to speak, where they're in contact with one another, not on an emotional level, but almost on an actuarial level.
They don't want to kill each other?
No. They don't fit the patterns.
They're like friends.
They're like acquaintances.
My guest before you came on is a Hollywood actress, and she has been getting letters from a serial killer. She doesn't want to tell us who he is for some specific reasons, but he continues to write her, and she says you know him. And fascinating episode that they're friendly to one. I mean, I told her, I said, Amanda, I wouldn't want these letters coming in. They're too creepy for me. What advice would you give her?
Don't open them. Send them back. Don't even give the satisfaction of knowing that he is in contact with you, that he's controlling you.
Is that what he's trying to do?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
She's read the letters. She's written him back.
She has?
Yes.
I would stop that.
So that's what he's trying to do.
He's trying to control her. And he also, in some ways, is a letter to a serial murderer is a concrete representation of a person. Since they don't get through that first phase of separation, they never can maintain in their head the picture of the caretaker or the picture of the relationship. They have to have a reminder. Letters are reminders. Souvenirs are reminders. Taking a license, taking a necklace, cutting off a finger. Those are absolute concrete things that they can say, see, this is what I did.
I'm going to, with your permission, give her one of your numbers, if that's okay.
That'd be fine.
She's already written your book, by the way. She brought her own in, and as a matter of fact, I am to send you mine because she's asking if you would sign it for her, and she won't give up the one she's got. So I'm going to do that.
That wouldn't be a problem.
But I'll pass your number
on. Please do.
And She's very well known out here and has been in some movies and things like that, and this is an area that she has gotten fascinated with. But, I want her to be as protected as possible, too.
Yes, because it's amazing. I could tell you some stories of what these people do that when you're in contact with them that would do what most people would say, creep you out.
Yes, absolutely. What are we doing as a country about serial killers? I mean, the FBI tries to profile. They've had some phenomenal success with that. But is it organized enough? Are we doing the right thing?
In my opinion, we're not. I mean, I usually bristle at the fact when somebody calls me a profiler, because what I am is a researcher, and I'm trying to put together characteristics. My goal and the FBI's goal or law enforcement's goals are very different. They want to catch him and put him away. The profilers that they talk about, well, it's one thing to collect data like I do, but the true job of a profiler should be to say, this is the guy. It's one thing to say, oh, well, look, this guy is kind of similar, but if we're profiling adequately enough, we should not have 10 people dead.
So we're not doing that well.
No, we're not doing that well at all. We're able now, it's much easier than it was when we began, where victims are classified according to DNA. We didn't have that 25 years ago.
It's easy. It's easier for police to catch, for example, a single killer than it is a serial killer.
Absolutely, because one of the things that people are taught is that everyone has a method, and it's their modus operandi, so to speak. Serial killers change theirs all the time. And it's almost like they're experimenting as a little kid would, for example, pulling the legs or wings off a fly to see what the thing's going to do. And what the serial murderer does is he does the very same thing with his human victims. He experiments with them. And he is never doing the same thing at all. He may have, certain little knots in his rope if he uses a rope, but he doesn't all the time.
Well, when we come back at the top of the hour, Helen, we'll go through some of the list of some serial killers and some names. We'll even talk about the person that Dracula was basically written about. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
The After Dark Newsletter. Subscribe now by calling toll-free 1-888-727-5505.